Welcome in. Let's talk about things that Linux can do that Windows cannot. So, package manager and software repositories. If you are a primarily Windows user and haven't experienced Linux, maybe until now, Linux can do something. It could have always done this. It's not a new thing. It's basically been there since the beginning of the first Linux distribution in the 90s. So package managers and software repositories are something akin to stores like Microsoft stores, App Store, Google Store, but they are the repository of all of the free software, I mean Libre software, that are available in this distribution. So, for example, if you pick Debian as your operating system, you will find roughly 60,000 to 70,000 packages inside the Debian official repository that are available for you to download and install. And the reason why I draw the line in parallel with app stores is because it kind of feels like it. Basically, if you need Firefox on Windows, what do? You go to the search engine, usually Google, you type download Firefox and it takes you to a certain link where you click the download button again and then it downloads something for you. And when this download finishes, then you click it to install it, then the installer pops up, then you click next, next, next. Sometimes you read what it says, sometimes you don't read what it says. But basically, eventually you finish this installer, and once the installer is finished, then your Firefox is installed and you can run it, and that's it. Usually this is no longer a process than 5 minutes, right? However, on Linux, this is usually done differently via package manager and package repositories. So as I said, if you are on something like Debian, you would just go to the one of the store apps, depending on which desktop environment you're using, but pretty much every desktop environment has its own built-in like a store app, which you will type Firefox into the search field, and it will show some results. You will click on Firefox, you will click on install, and the magic will happen, and that's it. You have Firefox now. So what it happens in the background is that when you use this store interface, this is not an actual store. This is just like a user interface that works with the background command line interface for you so that you don't have to type command line interface commands. If you would do that on Debian, it would be something like apt space install space Firefox, and then you would press enter and then it would download Firefox. If you do this through this GUI interface, graphical user interface, then it will do this for you, meaning it would present you with a Firefox as a choice. When you would click install, it would download Firefox from the Debian software repository, and it would automatically install it for you. So it's usually a process of like, 20 seconds, maybe 30, depending on your internet speed. But generally, it is much more practical, and it is a lot faster because all of the packages are well tested and integrated into this distribution, into this operating system that you have chosen out of all of the Linux flavors out there. So it kind of just works, you know, it's super easy to handle. If you want to know more about package managers, give it, I would say, a like, but what I want to say is type me a reply on this video so I know that there is demand for more in-depth explanation of how package managers work. And also welcome to our Linux world. So the second thing I would like to talk about is customization freedom. So of course, a lot of you are used to Windows where there isn't too much customization beyond the wallpaper and a little bit of theming. Is there anything else beyond that? I know that there used to be ways to customize the GUI shell on Windows XP and the older version of Windows, but nowadays it's somewhat locked in system. I mean, people still tend to replace the start menu on Windows 10. I'm not sure if that's still available on Windows 11, but generally there isn't much customization, right? On Linux, I remember one of my favorite questions that I get, especially from my in real life friends, is what does Linux look like? Yes, the answer is yes. I mean, for Windows, you have one desktop environment, which we will just call Windows for the sake of simplicity. On Linux, there is no Linux desktop environment. There is GNOME desktop environment. This one is really popular. There is KDE Plasma desktop environment, also another extremely popular one and very customizable on its own. These two look completely different, not even related in any way. So there is like System 76 company that is currently developing something called Cosmic. This is a new desktop environment that has a chance to become popular because, they are investing a lot of themselves into it. Also, you have stuff like Cinnamon, which is another desktop environment from the Linux Mint team. You have XFCE desktop environment. That's a very light on your resources. Like, it works on a lot older computers. It still looks good, but it requires a lot less CPU power, RAM power, RAM amount, I mean, but you know what I mean. So you have all these options, and this is just scratching the surface. You have like a gazillion of window managers. So what window managers are? These are not complete desktop environments, but basically like rising for your window managers in simplified terms is something that manages your windows, right? Something that decorates your windows with the toolbar and that helps you move things around, that helps you organize your windows. Usually it has some kind of a menu that helps you to start applications, find them, tile them, arrange them, move them around. You know, that's what window managers do. And every desktop environment also consists of window manager, but also plus the file manager and the as I said, store and all kinds of tools for configuring your system. So desktop environment is a lot more than just window manager, but some people like to customize things to a very deep very deeply. Let's say very deeply. So you can choose this window manager, combine it with this file manager that you took from XFCE desktop environment, but you're not using XFCE desktop environment, just their file manager because you like it, and you have combined it with this window manager here, and you will maybe use the wallpaper engine that gives you like animated wallpapers and stuff like that. You would use the screensaver from something else. You can combine all sorts of things, and it's really difficult to even combine these little facts into something coherent for this short video, because if I go slightly overboard than I already did, I'm going to confuse the hell out of you. And then you will ask for more, like give it to us in details. So if you do want me to go into details on how to customize the look and feel of your Linux desktop, also reply to this video so that I know how many of you are interested in this particular topic. So that would fall under customization freedom, and that's just scratching the surface. The visuals are not the only thing that can be customized. There is a lot more to customization. System resource efficiency. So Windows is very fixed and it requires this or that hardware. They also, Windows 11 also has this this line that you need to have a computer as new as this one and or newer, right? With Linux, you can basically go way back into the 2010s, you know. So a 15 years old laptop will work just fine with pretty much any Linux, provided that you take care about what you're loading. You know, web browsers are heavy, but other than that, you can choose XFCE, as I said, or just the window manager, and you can get your computer to a very, very, very usable state. So you can use very, very little RAM. Right now, on my T480 laptop, I am currently using just the DWM window manager. And when I start that together with the operating system, it takes about 100, maybe a little bit more, megabytes of RAM. I'm not joking. It's 150, like 0.1 gigabytes of RAM. I mean, I have 16 gigs of RAM on this one, but it's kind of cool to see what can you do. Another thing is strong community support. So I know that Windows has community support, but the way Linux community functions is all about free software. And when I say free software, I don't necessarily mean software that you don't have to pay for. Usually when we say free software, we mean software that is open source, that has a license that allows you to reuse this source code, to modify it, to distribute it around as your modified version of this software, and so on. Without complicating the licensing part too much. What I mean about the community support is, you know, if something is missing in Linux, there is always some part of the community that is already working on a solution for that particular niche. So I can almost guarantee 100% that whatever you really need as a solution to do something, there is someone already working on it. You just have to dig a little bit around and see into which community you're going to join and maybe help them out to speed them up a little bit and, you know, give yourselves into the community to become a part of the community. So that's how things roll in the Linux communities. You know, everyone is helping everyone else. And this is how we function. There would be no Linux without the community, without the people, because despite the fact that companies do invest themselves into developing some of the software on Linux, especially the Linux kernel, there is usually like the most of the effort or the weight falls onto the shoulders of the many, many, many individuals which are a part of this very, very large community. So it's kind of amazing, like truly is something amazing. Stability for servers, I don't believe that this is worth talking about too much, simply because everyone knows about it. You know, Linux is powering the majority of the internet, and that's just a very basic fact today. You know, when you connect to whatever somewhere with your Windows machine, you are usually connecting to a Linux server, whether it's a web page of some kind or a social network of some kind or a video game server of some kind. In the vast majority of cases, it's Linux on the other side. Then how do you even connect to the internet? You have some kind of a router in your home that usually your internet service provider has provided for you. This router is running which operating system? Linux, of course. I mean, you know, so it's a cool fact, you know. Almost everything is running on Linux, and it's an unavoidable fact, and it's pretty cool. The open source nature, well, this is one of my key points, but generally maybe I should have melted this with the community part, because the very essence of everything being open source and free software is the fact that everyone can look into the other people's homework and build and improve on that. So if you have the means and the knowledge to improve somewhere, you can always join some other open source community and help them grow faster, or you can just take their code and continue building it in your own garage, to put it like that, and maybe set up a team who will do it a lot better than the first team. So, you know, open source being open source, all of the knowledge is public, and it is how it is. That's how it rolls. Better privacy options. So this is a little bit more complex topic, but one of the very obvious things about anything being open source compared to being closed source, such as Windows, is that with closed source, you are unable to know what the operating system is doing. You can only believe what the maker is telling you in this kind of interesting comparison, which would be Microsoft. If Microsoft tells you that when they are taking data from your computer for their own telemetry, this is what they tell you on every Windows install, by the way, when they tell you that they are only taking this data and this data and this data, and they are avoiding taking any private data from your computer when they are sending to their servers for analytics, you can only believe them that this is what they're doing. There are ways that you can monitor which files are being accessed at which moment, but in general, you can never be 100% what is truly going on without some kind of a deep analysis and reverse engineering. With open source, on the other hand, everything is known, because all of the code is public, so everything that is programmed into your operating system is known in advance, that it doesn't do you know, any suspicious things in regards to privacy. In some cases, some of the open source software will come pre-compiled in a way that the telemetry will be like opt-out, which means that it will be enabled by default, and it will give you an offer to disable it if you don't want any of your private stuff being shared. And when I mean private, I don't necessarily mean private like your documents, but more usually it's like what you have installed. This is telemetry, right? I mean in general, what you have installed, what kind of hardware you have, and you know, etc. But generally, with open source, the privacy is a lot easier to handle, simply because of the fact that everything is displayed for everyone to see in terms of raw source code. So everything is known in advance what this software is doing on your computer. It gives you total control over your computer, like ultimate control. Reviving old hardware. So in one of my previous mentions, I said like some desktops and window managers are really, really good in handling very old hardware, and Linux as a kernel itself is fairly light, and you can also customize it to your heart's desire, and you can make your Linux use very, very little resources depending on what kind of software you run on it. But in general, you can really run Linux in 2025 on like 20, 30 even years old computers if you really want. Like, maybe I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but 15 years computers are no-brainer. 20 years old computers pretty much still handleable. If you go beyond 20 years, I would say it's becoming a stretch, but it depends on what you do on your computer. I spend quite a lot of time on my laptop learning programming, and the way that I learn programming really doesn't require almost any resources. So what I do on my computer actually can work on a 25-year-old computer, because what I learn is some basic C code, and my compiling lasts like a fraction of the second on this computer. So even if I would use like a 25 years old computer, my compilation time would maybe take a couple of seconds on the code on which I practice on, you know. But even if that would become a problem, I can always SSH into one of my other computers, which has a lot more power. So I would use that like old laptop for like a remote terminal. And you can absolutely do that. One of the cool things about Linux is being able to use a remote computer or a remote server as your remote horsepower. So, for example, if you're doing some really heavy programming in terms of really heavy compilation, like you are a video game developer and your laptop is compiling your video game for, I don't know, 10 minutes, and you change some code and you need to recompile everything for whatever reason, and you don't really want to wait 10 minutes, but you want to work on your laptop, you can, you know, write your code on your remote server, which is like 10 times stronger than your laptop, and you work there, but you pull your desktop or your programming IDE from the server to your laptop. So it's just displayed on your laptop, like it's local, but it's not. So it's working on the remote horsepower, and it will compile in 1 minute. Perfectly doable. Another thing, well, I kind of wrote myself multiple desktop environments, but I think I already passed on this topic, so let's skip this one. One other thing I have. When Linus Torvalds wrote Linux, back in the day, he was pretty much broke as a student. He was not able to afford, I think he wanted Minix back in the day. I think it costed money back in the day. Not anymore, but back then it did cost some money. And as far as I remember the storyline, he wanted to try to create something that would be free for everyone. And by free, I don't mean what we today call free software, but in the old language meaning of free, like free as in no money required to get it. That's how Linus Torvalds envisioned it in the first place. And then the GNU licensing happened afterwards, you know. But generally on Linux, you have all of the software of the world, and pretty much everything is free. You can, of course, support all of the developers that you like or want with money, but usually it's called donation and not necessarily a mandatory payment. You know, it's a very unlikely scenario that you will find software on Linux that is free software that is being gate kept with a paywall. So this is technically or legally possible, but usually you will be hard pressed to find something like that. So yeah, I mean, if you like this way of living, I would call this living a lifestyle, everything is free until you feel like you used some software to a lot of I was going to say degree, but let's just say When you have used some software so much and when it has given you back so much value, there is this natural happening. That's the wrong word. I'm not a native English speaker, but it happens automatically from within your own soul that you want to give money. You know, it kind of feels like that. So, you know, I donate as well when I feel like someone has earned my money. I don't have much, but you know, everyone gives as much as they can. And that's how the majority of free software developers function and live. Give it a like and subscribe on this video if you have liked it. And also please wait for the names to appear on the screen in a couple of seconds. These are my favorite supporters who, well, take care of my channel, and I am very thankful to them. Check them out. Thank you.